Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown, Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Tonight, we are going to do something a little bit different. You all know or have heard of John Dillinger. And we did a little bit of stuff on John Dillinger. I've got some more to do on him. I think he's a fascinating character. Public enemy number one at one point in time in the 1930s. Robbed banks all over the Midwest. Was like a folk hero to a lot of people out there in the Dust Bowl. You know, there's all kinds of rumors, like kind of like Jesse James. Up where I come from, there's stories get passed down that one time this man stopped by and the farm family fed him and let him stay overnight. And when he left the next day, he left a $20 gold piece. And then they found out later that was Jesse James and that money had just been stolen from the Liberty Bank or some other bank. John Dillinger kind of was the same way with the Dust Bowl farmers, and especially down in Oklahoma and Missouri and Kansas, where people were, it was a depression and people were poor. And they kind of saw, you know, somebody that, that bucked up against the system, because many of the rural farmers felt like the bankers were the ones that were taking their land away from them, and didn't really attribute it particularly to the failing crops and the Dust Bowl. The fact there, you know, was a long drought and they had been farming their land in such a way that all the topsoil blew off. So it was a variety of different geological and physical and social conditions that brought on the depression and brought on the Dust Bowl. But a lot of people lost their farms. They had them repossessed by the local bank. So these young guys who didn't have much opportunity here in the Midwest started robbing banks, and they started doing things like writing letters to the newspapers and claiming that they didn't do this job and didn't do that job. And I believe Clyde Barrow, Bonnie and Clyde, he wrote a letter to Henry Ford that I happened to see a copy of it one time and said, "Dear Mr. Ford, thank you for making the V8 engine. I really like that car," which helps me. I don't remember if he said it helps me get away from the police, but that was the subtext. That was the story behind it, really. So they became these kind of folk heroes, and John Dillinger was, he had such a cool name too. He had like a real, be like a Mickey Mantle is a real baseball player's name, or Roy Rogers is a real cowboy's name. Well, John Dillinger, that's like a real kind of anti-hero, Robin Hood kind of a character name, and that's what these guys were. Many of them, Babyface Nelson and Pretty Boy Floyd, they had these colorful nicknames, Bonnie and Clyde, Clyde Barrow, and the Barrow Gang, the Alvin Creepy Carpus, and the Ma Barker Gang. They had all these kind of memorable names. What we've done, we've gotten a friend of ours to do some dramatic readings. We kind of tried this before, and I read, and Aaron read, but this guy is a lot better reader and more articulate and more clear and straightforward with it, and he has a good, really good voice. So we're going to play some of those clips about John Dillinger's escape.
Now, they're actual newspaper clips.
From the time. You know, first what we call primary source documents that were written at the time he escaped from the Crown Point. It's Crown Point, Indiana. He was captured by Matthew Leach, the chief of the Indiana State Police, after committing a robbery at a bank located in East Chicago on January 15, 1934. Local police boasted to the newspapers that this jail at Grand Point, Indiana, was escape-proof, and they even posted extra guards just to make sure. The details are kind of cloudy. He escaped on March the 3rd, 1934, and there's been a lot of debate over this. One of the deputies, Ernest Blunk, claims that Dillinger had a real pistol. A check of the FBI files and any other experts on this will say that he carved a fake pistol out of a potato. Now, there was a trustee named Sam Cahoon, who probably was a town drunk like Otis on Andy Griffith in Mayberry. He was the first hostage that Dillinger took, and then it just went downhill from there, and he got out. Other people have said that there's a guy named Art O'Leary, claims he snuck a gun in himself. It was a real gun. The Midwest was on fire with this. It was unbelievable. Aaron, play that first clip. This is about a group of Chicago cops that thought that they had Dillinger cornered.
Chicago, December 22nd. A band of sharpshooting policemen bent on capturing John Dillinger and members of his ring of escaped Indiana convicts. Wrote Venise to the careers of three other gunmen with bullets in a sensational raid on an apartment in the Rogers Park District. In a short but decisive gunfight, the police killed the trio last night, and for 2 hours afterwards, believed that their victims were Dillinger and two of his lieutenants, Jack Hamilton and Harry Pierpont. Fingerprints taken from the dead men, however, reveal that they were Louis Katzkowitz, age 28, and Charles Tattlebaum, age 30, alias Chuck Tilden, both of whom were suspected of helping to hold up the Union National Bank of Streeter, Illinois, and Sam Ginsburg, age 33, a paroled convict from the Michigan State Prison at Jackson. A total of $52,000 was obtained in the bank robbery, which occurred May 16, 1932. Katzkowitz and Tattlebaum had been sought since last June 15th when they escaped from jail at Ottawa, Illinois. Receiving a tip from an unidentified informant that the first floor apartment at 1428 Farwell Avenue was a hideout for Dillinger and his men, 19 picked officers led by supervising captain John Stege swooped down on the place, posting men with submachine guns at the rear to cut off escape in that direction. Captain Stege, Sergeants Frank Reynolds, Harry Newman, and Harry Bingham remained in front with a group of their men. After one policeman had forced open the door to a stair leading to the apartment, Sergeant Jack Reynolds, Detective Jack Daw, and Captain Stege, with several others, crept up. The bell of the apartment door was rung, and when the door was opened, Sergeant Reynolds leaped forward, shouting, "We're police officers! Surrender!" Instead of doing so, the man at the door fired three times but hit no one. Forcing his way in, Reynolds dropped his foe with two shots in the head. The second of the trio of gunmen also fell before Reynolds' deadly aim as he stood in the living room with two pistols in his hands. He had blazed away blindly at Reynolds and Captain Stege and the other policemen, who by this time were storming into the place. The third gunman, firing at the policeman as he backed into the kitchenette, fell wounded before the police bullets and was finally killed by Sergeant John Daly. Captain Stege said his information that the men in the apartment were connected with the Dillinger gang came from a woman. Daniel Gilbert, chief investigator for the state attorney's office, said he had been informed that the trio knew the Dillinger crowd but were not allied with him in their activities. The police said they learned that the apartment raided was that of Mr. and Mrs. Robert Marmer, who occupied it for about a year. Mrs. Marmer and her brother, Leonard Pritzament, found in the same building, were arrested. Marmer was sought. The investigators, however, were unable to establish what connection, if any, there was between the Marmers and the slain men.
That was quite a shootout, wasn't it? That reminded me of my old SWAT days. You get the big guy up front and kick in the door, and you go charging in into a room full of people that got guns. Only we never had them shoot back at us. Usually they always just gave up. That was quite a deal. And man, they just started popping rounds and just taking everybody out immediately. I don't think they really gave anybody a chance to give up in that deal. They thought they had Dillinger.
Now, Rogers Park District, is that part of Chicago?
Yeah, that's in Chicago. These were Chicago cops.
And this was 1420 Falwell Avenue, which probably still exists in Chicago.
Oh, it might. It might. You people up in Chicago have to go by and take a look at that address, 1422 Farwell? Falwell.
1422 Falwell Avenue.
F-A-L-W-E-L-L. Yeah, it's probably an old, brownstone or some kind of an old apartment building down there and close to downtown Chicago. Let us know. You Chicago fans, let us know where that place is. Maybe take a picture of it and send it to us.
We'll talk about a couple guys in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Well, that they were bank robbers, too.
Jack Hamilton and Pierpont.
They were all...
Maybe, if they didn't think it was Dillinger, they probably wouldn't have come in quite so strong.
They wouldn't have come in guns blazing, and they did come in guns blazing. That image of that Sergeant Frank Reynolds standing up there blazing away with two guns. Can you imagine? That's the stuff TV shows are made out of and movies.
Yeah, I don't know. They, they got to be committed to their job.
Yeah.
I mean, if they're going through the door and they think it's Dillinger, Dillinger's already been known to kill people.
Yes, shoot back.
To shoot back.
You know, today people don't really shoot back at the police very much, but especially the professional criminals. It's usually just the drugged out, crazed idiots that ever shoot back at the police. The real deal criminals know they're better off not shooting back, but they did
mostly
back
because
then.
Because when they do, the police shoot back to kill.
They shoot back to kill, and they're much better trained and more cooler and calmer under the circumstances than the bad guys are for the most part. Plus, if you take out one cop, there's about four or five more that are going to be flying in anyhow. Kind of like, my gang's bigger than your gang, so bring it on. At least that's what we used to tell some of those kids. All right, Aaron, let's get into the actual jailbreak itself. I just wanted to play that one to kind of show you, set the scene for what the times were like back then. And it's a little bit different than it is today.
Chicago Tribune. Tuesday, March 6th, 1934. Arrest 2 in jailbreak. Deputy and trustee are charged with aiding Dillinger. Warrant served on two men by state police after investigation of jailbreak by officers of the Attorney General's office. The warrants were served by Indiana State Police at the request of Edward J. Barse, Deputy Attorney General assigned to investigate a notorious convict's escape with a toy pistol. Cahoon, who had served two sentences for intoxication, was turnkey at the jail. Blunk, fingerprint expert for the sheriff's office, was kidnapped by Dillinger and taken as far as Piatone, Illinois, before he was let out. Barsh said he would take the men into court this afternoon and demand that they be held under high bonds. Cahoon was permitted to enter and leave the cell blocks at will, Barsh said his investigations disclosed. In addition to his duties as turnkey, he ran errands for the prisoners. Blunk, although paid by criminal court, had the privilege of locking and unlocking cells as he pleased, Barsh said. Barsh said his investigation revealed that Cahoon was the person who had unlocked cell and corridor doors when Dillinger made his escape.
Well, that's what they thought at the time. They thought that Cahoon and Blunt, who was a fingerprint examiner, and Cahoon was Otis was the town drunk. I noticed they said he had two prior arrests for intoxication, and pretty much had to run to the jail. You know, when I first came on the police department, we had a couple guys like that that they spent more time in jail than out, and they liked it. They wouldn't send them on out to the city farm. They'd keep them as trustees around the city jail to help clean up and run errands and do all kinds of stuff. They actually kind of liked it. And then eventually they'd get released and they'd go back out, and they didn't last long on the streets. They'd rack up another arrest for public intoxication. They'd bring them back down and 'cause they wanted to, they liked that. That was their identity. And that's what I'd say Cahoon was. The other guy, I can't quite figure out what his deal was. I don't know if
a bored fingerprint guy.
A bored fingerprint guy.
I fingerprint a lot of folks, but nobody as famous as John Dillinger.
Really? Dillinger probably had a lot of money. He probably...
How much on him, though? They wouldn't have incarcerated him with cash on him.
Well, Dillinger probably had enough contacts that he had somebody come down with some money. Don't you imagine? That would be my take on that.
That somebody showed up with a potato and a lot of cash.
Right, right. And
something to carve it with.
Right. I mean, you think in 1934, somebody bring you $10,000 in cash, that'd be like bringing you $100,000 today.
I mean, if you're Otis.
Yeah, if you're Otis.
I like that interesting term they use, turnkey.
Turnkey, yeah. That's an old-timey term. If you're the turnkey, then you're the guy, kind of the like boss of the cell block.
Like you have a set of keys to let people in and out.
Right, right. I think that goes all the way, probably all the way back to, you know, like the turn of the century or even before when, you know, the jail and prison conditions, since they want to keep down the overhead, they would appoint certain people. And you think about, you see these chain gangs and movies about the southern prison farms, they'd select certain people and they would they'd be prisoners, but they'd be able to carry the guns and oversee all the prisoners, and you know, they just are likely to shoot you, even more likely to shoot you if you're trying to run off than the prison guard. So that's,
yeah, they didn't want to lose their job and have to do some real hard work.
Yeah, they had to do their time, so might as well make it easy. And they didn't mind if they were tough enough to, or maybe in the case of this guy, he was obsequious enough and kind of helped things get run right. Why, you know, you could do it, and you'd have a much easier spin in jail. You know, they had
now, they probably would have gotten Cahoon's life story and made a movie of it.
Yeah.
Having let John Dillinger out.
Let's play the next clip.
Sioux Falls, South Dakota, March 6th. Six bank bandits armed with three submachine guns today sped through South Dakota with four girls as hostages after robbing the Security National Bank here of about $18,000 and seriously wounding a motorcycle policeman. One of the bandits looked like John Dillinger, President C.H. Clark of the bank said after he had been shown a picture of the notorious Indiana outlaw.
You know, Aaron, from my review of the newspaper clips at the time, and I found more than one article like this, they were seeing Dillinger everywhere in the Midwest. Every bank robbery that went down, no matter who by, they wanted to be robbed by Dillinger, and they wanted to think it was Dillinger. So that's just one example of several that happened at the time. I could get some more and read them and play them.
Yeah, I was going to say, because he dropped the one officer off at, what was it, Retinaw, Illinois?
Yeah.
When he's like, okay, we got out of jail, now we're going into the middle of Illinois, I guess.
And right, he was headed north. Last time he was seen, he was headed north, and this was on up in, where was that, South Dakota, I think?
Yeah, this was Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Which is kind of not quite the southeast corner of South Dakota, but if you're taking, I don't know if they had, they didn't really have an interstate at that time.
No, it would have taken a while to get up there on the back roads.
The cat roads.
The cat roads, you remember that. And our friend Terrence O'Malley told us about the cat roads and this guy, the Tri-State Terror, Wilbur Underhill, the Tri-State Terror. I think he created some maps of the, well, for me, there were probably dirt roads back then. When I was a kid, there were gravel roads and or farm-to-market roads or farm roads, and he created maps of these roads, how you could stay off the major roads, like in Missouri, 71 Highway goes north and south through Joplin to Kansas City, and it's kind of the major road north and south. Well, you could go into southern Missouri and on into Arkansas, but he'd stay off of 71 Highway by going on these blacktop now, but either gravel or dirt roads, and they called them the cat roads, and that's what they would have taken to get up into South Dakota, although I guess it wasn't really them, but they thought it was. Everybody, every time something happened, they thought it was Dillinger. We have another case, and I got the ads, the clips on it. There's two state patrolmen that were killed right after the Union Station massacre down in the central part of the state. And at the time, everybody thought it was Pretty Boy Floyd and Adam Ricchetti, who were already being accused of being part of the massacre and
at Union Station,
and this was just a few days later, and two state patrolmen were killed by two bank robbers who had just robbed I can't remember the name of the small town, I want to say Slater or something like that, and small town bank in mid part of the state, and then he caught them going through Sedalia and tried to stop them, and they killed him. So turned out later on it was a little gang of bank robbers that lived on a farm up in Iowa that nobody had ever heard of. They were sure it was Pretty Boy Floyd. So these famous names, they got a lot more credit for a lot more crime than they actually did.
Well, so maybe. I mean, they say there's whatever the car was, or if there were two cars, but definitely they knew there were six guys robbing the bank, and only three of them had guns.
Yeah.
Which, you know.
That didn't make sense either, does it? That wasn't John Dillinger's gang, was it?
I don't know. And then there's four girls leaving town with him. as hostages? Where did those girls come from?
Good question. Well, how big a car? You ask all the hard questions.
How big a car are these guys driving?
That wasn't the most accurate reporting,
I'm
probably.
I'm just curious, you know. It begs to be asked.
Begs the question, as they say.
Chicago, March 6th. An army of plainclothes men in bulletproof vests massed in Chicago's north side today and patrolled the vicinity of Loop Banks in a search for John Dillinger, desperate Indiana outlaw. Information that the escaped convict planned to rob the Builders Bank led to a concentration of forces there. Warning that Dillinger, whose escape Saturday from the Crown Point, Indiana jail started one of the largest manhunts in history, planned to rob the large Builders Bank today, came to police during the night. Deputy Chief of Detectives William Blahl said the source of information was considered authentic. If accurate, the tip would indicate that police had gained at least a slender clue to the desperado's whereabouts. A hunt for Dillinger centered in Chicago late yesterday after police found the automobile of Sheriff Lillian Holly of Crown Point, in which Dillinger fled. Detective Lorimore Hyde reported that he had pursued the automobile Saturday unsuccessfully. License plates on the automobile revealed that the first warnings broadcast from Crown Point gave the wrong numbers for the plates. Hyde followed the sheriff's automobile because it bore Indiana license plates. He noticed the plates did not agree with the description provided by Indiana authorities, but lost the automobile because of heavy traffic. The hunt for Dillinger was under the direction of Supervising Captain John Steege, whose shoot-on-site campaign in January forced the Dillinger gang to leave the city. With Sergeant Frank Reynolds, whose brushes with criminals have allowed him to put 13 notches on his gun, Steege followed clues obtained in the Indiana State investigation of the jailbreak.
Thirteen notches on his gun for brushes. I had a brush with a criminal myself, but I never put a notch in anything.
Well,
let alone 13 of them.
You should have. You'd had that knife that our friend Mark McNally gave you, and you'd have cut that guy's throat that robbed you that night. You could have put a notch in your knife.
Put a notch in my knife.
Yeah. Well. John Reynolds, he's got 13 notches in his gun. Frank Steege, Captain Steege, they were the same two that were on that other raid where they shot and killed those three bank robbers. So
that weren't John Dillinger. These guys are John little trigger happy.
Yes, they are. These Chicago, this crew here, this must have been what we used to call those, Major Case Squad or the 7-Ups. There's a movie about the 7-Ups. They only went after the criminals who got 7 years or up in their penitentiary sentences, or the
6 feet under squad.
6 feet under squad. This was like the El Salvadorian death squads or something on criminals. They're bad. Did you realize that the sheriff of that ran that jail in Crown Point, Indiana, was a female sheriff in 1934, Lillian Holly. I'd kind of forgotten about that till they said her name. They stole her car, and then they got the plates wrong when they put out the APB or the Be on the Lookout For, whatever they called it back then. But it was a female sheriff. I'll put a picture of her up on the there's a picture of her with Dillinger, kind of a publicity shot that she had done, put in the papers when he first came to her jail. She was pretty proud that she had Dillinger in her jail.
Until he escaped.
Until he escaped. She wasn't so proud of that then.
Yeah, and then took her car.
And took her car, too.
She's like, I wish I had a notch in my car.
Well, interesting. You know, who'd have thought there was a female sheriff of was supposedly escape-proof jail in Crown Point, Indiana in 1934. I was really kind of flabbergasted when I first read that.
You know, every time they say they have an escape-proof jail, yeah, it's usually immediately followed by a story about somebody escaping. Like John Dillinger.
Right.
Let alone earlier on when they said it was an escape-proof jail, but they posted extra guards.
Yeah, I noticed the
I was like, wait a
discrepancy
second.
There.
I thought it was escape-proof before the extra guards.
This was John Dillinger, man. This was John Dillinger.
You get your photo before he escapes.
And she did that. Get your publicity shot with John Dillinger before he escapes.
Yeah, don't wait for that.
All right. I think it's time to say goodnight, Aaron. Say goodnight.
Goodnight, Aaron.